recommend it. If you're using it, he can document that you're using it, and just that he knows that you're using it, and he's aware of that. That is enough. That is a state law. I don't know about the city council law.
So let me understand this, Robert. That in other words, the doctor doesn't have to say, I prescribe marijuana. All he has to do is say, I'm aware you're using marijuana.
Yes.
And that is one of the appropriate treatments for this condition.
As a matter of fact, yes, and it has to be that way legally because, as you know, cannabis, otherwise known as marijuana, is not a medicine according to the federal government. Mm-hmm. And any doctor that ever prescribed it would be immediately lose their medical license because a doctor cannot prescribe any medicine that is not, you know, put out on the market by a major pharmaceutical company or such. Mm-hmm. This is the legal area, the gray area, but I'm very aware of it. And the language of the law has been changed, and like you were trying to point out to him, that there, if a doctor has to prescribe it, we're all doomed, because the federal government is not letting anyone use it for any reason whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, noted author Peter McWilliams was murdered by the federal government just 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago.
Tell me about that.
He was arrested. He was part of the cannabis castle down south.
Mm-hmm.
And I have his whole thing here. William F. Buckley even wrote it up in a lot of newspapers. It was carried. But let's see. Where is it? Here it is. There's so many. Well, Peter McWilliams. Here it is. Let's see. Federal judge in California, George King, would decide in a few weeks how long a sentence to hand down and whether to send McWilliams to prison or let him serve his sentence at home. He was looking at 5 years federal prison.
For
it says right here, what was his offense? He collaborated in growing marijuana plants.
Mm-hmm.
What was his defense? Well, the judge wouldn't allow him to plead his defense to the jury. If given a chance, the defense would have argued that under Proposition 215, passed into California constitutional law in 96, infirm Californians who got medical relief from marijuana were permitted to use it. The judge also forbade any mention that McWilliams suffered from AIDS and cancer and got relief from marijuana.
Incredible.
So what was he doing when he died? McWilliams was vomiting. You see, he was in his bathtub and he choked to death on his own vomit. He was forbidden to use medical marijuana under the federal law. This has just happened. This happened in 2000.
When did he die? 2 weeks ago.
He died 2 weeks ago.
And marijuana is a treatment that stops you from vomiting?
That is right. He could have been taking Marinol, but the judge forbade him to use Marinol, which is the only legal prescribed medicine. And as a matter of fact, the only reason he was out free at all because his mother and brother put up their homes for bail. And one of the conditions, the DEA called his mother personally and said, if your son tests positive for any cannabis in his bloodstream, you will lose your home.
And what was the total amount of the bail?
It was whatever the worth of their two homes together. It was some outrageous amount.
But sounds like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah, many, many hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And there was even a 2020 segment on June 9th. John Stossel summarized it. And everyone basically knew he was going to die, and they did. They basically killed him. They wouldn't let him use his medicine. They wouldn't let him plead any defense. None. They stripped him of all of his defenses. And they wouldn't even let him refer to California's 215. Now, this wasn't just any man. He has sold over 20 million books. Peter McWilliams is a noted author, and he's been on the New York Bestseller Times list for the last 25 years on and off.
Remind me of some of his book titles.
Oh, let's see. What are some of his books here? He wrote so many, but his last one was Ain't Nobody's Business If You Do, The Absurdity of Consensual Crimes in a Free Society.
Yeah, I'd have to read it.
Yeah, and let's see. In 1967, he started with some poetry books. He wrote How to Survive the Loss of Love, sold more than 2 million copies.
I've heard of that book, yeah.
Meditation, he wrote a book about meditation. I think it said Meditation More Popular Than Sex or something. The Personal Computer book, what was it? You Can't Afford the Luxury of a Negative Thought, a book for people with any life-threatening illness, including life. That was another one of his books, Life 101, Everything We Wish We Had Learned in Life, in School, but Didn't. A New York Times bestseller, both in hardcover and paperback. Do It, Let's Get Off Our Butts. Wealth 101, Wealth is Much More Than Money. And in 92, his first book of photography, Portraits, a 22-year anthology of his photographic work. All of them, he was on Oprah Winfrey, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Donahue, and Regis Philbin before he met Kathy Lee. So, that was just a summary of some of his books. And forbidden by the federal government to use any cannabis medicine or to make any reference to our state law. And you know what? He also sued Attorney General Lundgren last year. Were you aware of that?
No, give me some details.
It hasn't been in any media, of course. None of this has. But, last year I saw the lawsuit myself. He sued because the federal government was prosecuting him and was letting him die in jail. And he sued Attorney General Lundgren to uphold his constitutional duty to protect the health of the citizens of California, which Lundgren has not done. And that lawsuit was thrown out, or something became of it such as that. It never got...
How long was he in jail for?
He was used like a ping pong ball in and out of jail all last year. It made some media headlines, but they kept using him basically like a little ping pong ball. In and out of jail, they denied his medicine, he almost died, then the judge ruled that was cruel and unusual punishment, he got out, and then this other judge overruled that. I mean, it's a long, complex, legal volleyball.
Has anybody written a good history of this?
Online. I found many good things. I've even written, did a flyer about it that I'm trying to get out. I put one up at Bookshop Santa Cruz, but I haven't really had a lot more chance to go out flying.
Do you have a web page you want to give out on the air?
That would be really great. I have one, and it's www.mapinc.org, and that's MAPINC.org, and /alert/0169.html. Will take you exactly to Pyramid Williams.
And run through that one more time
right,
for those who didn't have a pen.
That's great. If you go to mapinc.org, that's www.mapinc.org, and look for Peter McWilliams, or go to the /alert/0169.html.
And for those who didn't catch all that, you can give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and hopefully we will have that at least later today. What you might do is call that number yourself, Robert, and give that number to my producer, your number to my producer off the air, so we can make sure that if anybody calls in, they can we can leave a message for you. I take it are you interested in fielding calls of people who want to make sure that the same fate does not happen to local marijuana activists?
That might be good. Could you repeat for I didn't quite get the HUFF 442?
It's 423.
Okay, great.
HUFF,
okay,
HUFF, great. Or 4833, if you will.
Thing. Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because I'm not sure which locality. He was Southern California, but I don't know. People are delusional here if they think we are. It's weird because we're in this quasi-state council. You know, we're in a feel-good Santa Cruz here. People are out celebrating their sexual identities and their religious cultural heritages, and that's wonderful. But meanwhile, we're all in danger because the feds are not respecting three-quarters of American people who say it's between a doctor and a patient, even a physician. If it was a physician, that would mean an herbalist could recommend it, but that's why they changed the language of 215 to make it say only medical doctor, and that's a political move. And no medical doctor could never prescribe cannabis because it's illegal under federal law.
So we have a situation where I know Kate Wells Cannabis Club, it's called...
They're walking a very fine tightrope.
That they are...
careful.
Todd Macaria is, in essence, providing some kind of... I don't know if he's prescribing it or...
He recommends it.
Or recommending it, I guess.
There's a big difference in the legal world between one word.
Now, does the city council resolution require prescription or recommendation? I guess
I'm not so up on it, but I'll tell you what. The city council can do whatever it wants, but until people like McWilliams aren't... None of us are safe. If they can go after a person who sold 20 million copies of books and use him like a ping pong ball, we're all a herd of sheep just looking over to the side of the fence.
Now, do you have an organization you're working with that you want to encourage people to...
No, I'm just a fellow work comrade, individual person in this world.
All right, Robert. Well, keep up the good work.
All right. Have a great one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well, since we've turned a little to marijuana, and it looks like the phones are now going to be ringing a bit, maybe my producer can get a hold of Kate Wells and see if we can get her on the air to clarify just what the local city law is.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
It's just me again, Robert. Just a brief comment. This is all about pushing the envelope. Medical marijuana is, of course, up against federal law. Always has been. And it will ultimately produce, on a variety of level, as it is now, challenges. And in some cases, feds are going to look the other way, and in some cases, they're going to crush the opposition. This is due process. This is history. Thanks for letting me get on the air.
Sure.
Well, I would call it more doo-doo process than due process, but I guess that's just my view. I'm going to try to get through to Kate Wells and see what I can do. I'm also going to read an article from Highwitness News, latest issue on the forfeiture update. I think we...
Hi, Kate Wells?
Yes.
Hi, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz giving you a Sunday call to disturb your peace of mind.
Oh, okay.
You are live on the air, so watch out. You can curse all you want, but don't reveal any dirty secrets.
Okay.
We were having a discussion about the Sunday Sentinel's coverage of the medical marijuana law. You may have seen it.
I haven't seen it yet, no.
Well, the question is, did the city council change the wording of the law to make it more restrictive? And can you clarify what happened there?
Yes. Well, actually, when we talked to John Barisoni about this, when we saw the new... the new variation on the ordinance with the, you know, the elimination of the words that all you needed was a diagnosis, they, I guess, were as shocked as anyone. They had never intended, according to him, to be more liberal than the law. The actual 11362.5.
Which is not 215, right?
Yes.
It is 215. Okay.
Well, I mean, it's the codification of 215.
Because we just heard from a caller that that if doctors attempt to actually prescribe marijuana, they're subject to federal penalties. The best they can do is recommend it.
Right. They can't prescribe. No doctor can prescribe. All we need under the law is a recommendation.
I see.
Right.
But still, this law, it was tighter than it had been in April?
Yes, yes. In the initial hue and cry about this new law came from the fact that Santa Cruz was going to be the most liberal county, at least in one aspect, of any in the state, and that would be that you didn't need a recommendation from a doctor. All you needed was a diagnosis of a condition for which cannabis can be used medically. When we all complimented them on such a progressive stance, they
immediately ran the other way, right?
Oh my God, we're being progressive. Well, we better do something about that. So they went back and changed the wording so that it requires the recommendation.
Now, is that significant? How will that impact people trying to get medical marijuana?
Well, it is in a couple of aspects. Number one, one of the things that we're seeing on a regular basis is that those who are veterans and who are dealt with by the Veterans Administration Hospital can't get recommendations. The feds, in fact, I have a brand new case of one of our patients. I haven't got his permission to talk about it, but I will talk about it without mentioning his name. He actually is a commercial truck driver, and he mentioned to his VA doctor that he uses marijuana for his medical condition, which is a valid medical condition. And nothing happened. They refused to recommend. But then when it came up time for them to sign his certification so that he could renew his commercial driver's license, they refused.
Why did they refuse?
Because he smokes marijuana for medical use.
I see. So he's not being prosecuted. He is just being barred from his livelihood.
That's it. That's it. So we've got, those continue to be problematic. Those where, you know, their primary physicians happen to depend on the federal government in some manner for their income. Another instance of one of our patients whose doctor refuses to recommend because she does a lot of expert testimony and is afraid that that will taint her expert testimony. So there are a variety of reasons why doctors and you're right, one of them is fear of retribution from the feds. It's a false fear. It's a completely made up fear. No one has ever been stopped by the federal government in the state of California, and no one will, frankly, because they understand that the Ninth Circuit has given us the right to put on a medical necessity defense, on behalf of any of these people, and they also realize that the vote, the juries that are pulled from the state of California, even if it's a federal court, are not going to convict them. Mm-hmm. Period. So it's you know, it, like I said, and the other issue being, God, you know, you asked me one question, I tell you.
Hey, that's why I called you.
Go on forever.
We want our legal eagle here.
Yeah, the other ridiculous part of it and is that if all of the doctors stood tall together and said, you know, we're going to prescribe this because the DEA itself has said that it is one of the most effective and safe medicines in the world, then what are they going to do? Come out and take everybody's license away? You know, they're just not going to do it, period. So it's something the doctors are hiding behind, and I don't know why, but...
Now, getting back to the harder questions of our local physicians,
yeah.
If you were to estimate, what percentage of the physicians are actually willing to recommend marijuana locally? I know that Todd McAria had to be called in from, 70, 80 miles away up in Berkeley to come on down and, you know, people got to pay him, I don't know, what is it, $100, $150 a hit to get a recommendation,
uh-huh.
Assuming, you know, I mean, I'm saying it's a valid approach, considering maybe the time involved and mm-hmm. so forth. But what about our local physicians here? Have any of them agreed to do this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, a huge number.
More than half? I mean, do you think this is...
Oh, no, not more than half, but then not more than half. I mean, you know, of those physicians who treat conditions for which medical marijuana is recommended, I would say that it's, well, God, you know, I couldn't give you a percentage. I can't give you a percentage. I can give you numbers. And the numbers out of the number of patients we have some, I think it's close to like 75 to 80 different doctors recommending.
So it's not a problem. People can go to their local doctors to get recommendations if they have these conditions.
Absolutely, and if they turn you down, you challenge them on it, and you say, I mean, we have agencies. For instance, county health is making recommendations in appropriate cases.
Now, is the turn down a frequent or a rare thing here in this county?
I would say it's increasingly rare.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, like I said, we have county health recommending, we have Planned Parenthood recommending, we have doctors at Doctors on Duty, we have, a huge number, and it's increasing on a daily basis, and I think as the confidence grows and they look around and realize that the feds haven't come down on the doctors who are recommending, then it'll become so commonplace that it, you know, won't be an issue.
Now, the article today in the Sentinel suggests that you've been having problems finding a new mm-hmm. place for you.
Right.
What is it called? Santa Cruz Pharmaceuticals?
Santa Cruz Cannabis Pharmaceuticals, right?
Right, could they also mention that only you and Valerie Corral are the clubs in town? But in fact, there's, I guess, Anita Henry has MedX.
Uh-huh.
And isn't there some other group, too, that...
They have been closed down.
Really?
Yeah.
What group was that?
That was Fred Psyche.
And what was that group called?
I don't know.
I see. Just wondering.
I have no idea. And that there's also, just to be on the safe side, the rumor was that it had been closed down by the city. I heard on Friday from one of its former members that they had closed down voluntarily. So I don't know what the real story is there.
Fred Psyche was, everyone used to work together in the old Santa Cruz Cannabis Club.
Right.
In the good old days. Actually, Free Radio was in that building as
That's
well.
That's correct.
Now, on another subject, Jerry Henry case went to the jury and came out with a verdict. Have you been following that?
Yeah.
Would you like to give me your legal and human perspective on that case?
Well, I can't say I wasn't shocked. I did get to sit in on bits and pieces of testimony, and I expected a defense verdict all the way. And I guess, I don't know, it's the power of the almighty dollar. All I can think is that people have fallen back into this, it's all right to do social cleansing as long as somebody's making a profit because of it, you know? And that was what the whole case was about, is, you know, the district attorney acting as a private attorney for the merchants of Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center. So, you know, it has bearing in terms of what's happening downtown. I think it's a really sad commentary that, you know, people are willing to do something like that, especially after all the testimony that the jury heard in terms of the incredibly good acts that Jerry performs in a, you know, social way, that's helping the children and feeding people.
We're talking about the barring of essentially a street minister, a disabled man who nonetheless was apparently instrumental in affecting the lives of a number of young people at the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, but his manner was a sort of a threadbare clothing approach, and advice to youngsters not to take, to require that police officers and security guards respect their rights, and not that they not be moved along if they feel they have a legitimate reason for being there. And apparently he became targeted, and they started using charges of opportunity against him.
Yeah, when the sheriff's substation moved in there, they started acting, like I said, as a private security force for the merchants there. And, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court made it quite clear in the Pruneyard decision that when you build a shopping center in the kind of the center of town, which is what they've done there, and there is no alternative, for lack of a better word, hangout place for the kids, that's what happens. And basically the Pruneyard decision says, you know, you got to put up with that. If you're going to do that, you know, if you're going to take up the major real estate in the center of town, then you got to realize that you are going to be a central meeting pit place. So as far as I'm concerned, all of the behavior, I mean, the kids never did anything awful. They were being kids. You know, they play their guitar, you know, a hacky sack. They sat around and talked, and philosophized and wrote poetry and cartoons, and they got crucified for it on a regular basis. I mean, you know, it's almost as if the cops would rather they be off in an alley somewhere shooting up, you know, and not bothering us. Please don't bother us. We just don't want to deal with you, okay? It's a real sick, and to me, a real reflection of how much society hates children. I mean, I really think this is a reflection of how we are not. I mean, we pay lip service to, you know, to the children, but in a real sense here, I think we see the hostility towards kids for just being kids.
You know, in a related, not really that related, it is related in a way, the City Council decided this week to kill the safe sleeping zones.
Yeah.
I should say Catherine Byers decided to kill the safe sleeping zones.
What a debacle.
You yourself have been an attorney who took on dozens of cases of people who were protesting at City Hall back in 1996. Dan Hopkins' case, I guess, the appeal failed because Judge Kelly ruled that Hopkins' rights were not violated because, although he couldn't sleep at night, he could still sleep during the day, and so therefore everything was okie dokie.
You leave it to the courts to always find some argument that I never even thought of.
Yeah, why can't you sleep during the day, man?
Yeah.
So have you been following this controversy?
Yeah.
And would you like to give us your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's appalling. I think that you know, if we take it back to, and I've done this many times, if we change it to say, okay, these are people of poor economic status, if we change this to being, these are our black people, for instance, there is no way that anyone would countenance saying that no black person can sleep between 11 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the morning. But because these people are poor people, it's okay to say this. And I guess the really sick part about it is that the City Council should realize that from a social justice standpoint, and from a as far as I'm concerned, even from a legal constitutional that this law is wrong. You know, I mean, it's not right, and for them to bow again to economic considerations, which are political considerations, which includes their re-election and all of the other things, and all of this outpouring and screaming of people who are anticipating problems. Not even, you know, these are not even real problems yet. It's just appalling.
Well, there are also problems that have been provoked in part by the refusal of Dick Wilson and his staff to put in porta potties and dumpsters, as was, in essence, mandated by City Council, not just on May 23rd when they passed the first reading of this Safe Zones law, but also way back in March of 1999, over a year ago, mm-hmm. when the Crone-Crapper Commission, the bathroom commission on bathrooms passed by Councilmember Crone, said put these, put bathrooms, not just porta potties, but bathrooms into affected areas. So they have been sitting on their hands on this issue. In fact, when Crone went to, Matt Farrell and said, do it, Farrell reportedly refused to do it. And Wilson, when I went to him last week, said, oh, we're not going to do that. You know, and I said, well, he says, besides, we have a revolt from the staff on our hands and all these, you know, these hypodermic needles and piles of crap and trash and mattresses. And I said, well, then perhaps you could give me a list of the documented incidents. And he said, I have no such list. Mm-hmm. But
incredible. Well, you know, what's even more appalling, I guess it's business as usual as far as politics, and Catherine Byers is certainly, you know, I guess it's not that shocking to me that she has done this. I guess the really appalling part is the outpouring from the public. I should think that people would be so thrilled to have some way of resolving this in a manner where at least some people are going to be able to sleep at night in a safe situation, and instead it's just this.
I don't think it's the public, Kate. I think it's a very focused, small segment of business owners who are highlighted by the Sentinel. I know the Sentinel rejected several editorials that I and others tried to put into the Sunday section, instead focusing on those who oppose the changes. And also, there was an analysis done by Becky Johnson that will appear in the upcoming issue of Street Spirit. I've actually already put it on the email. You probably read it on your email if you're still getting it.
Yep.
Called, Texas Smoke, Mirror, and Texas Instruments. I think I titled it Texas Instruments Takes a Dump on the Safe Zones, because much of the email traffic came from Texas Instruments. I think we added up, there are 18 people in the city who oppose the safe sleeping zones in terms of letters. Which did, you know, in the last couple of weeks, vastly outnumber those who supported them, because there wasn't an indication. I mean, we were told
no
it's a done deal, you know, and also the whole thing was done behind closed doors.
It's politics in the worst sense of the word. I mean, it's lulling it you into a false sense of security, and then zinging you at 1 o'clock in the morning when no one's even there.
Yeah,
to
and arresting me too, Kate. They hauled my ass out of there with
you
four
again?
Cops. You got it, man.
Oh,
and I was barred from the next council meeting. I want legal representation, which actually brings me to the next issue, which is the perennial issue for you, which you hear about a lot.
Yeah.
But in Austin, Texas, the city law against sleeping was in part overturned. In Atlanta, Georgia, a settlement was reached around these kinds of behaviors, police harassment of homeless when they have no legal places to go. And, of course, Miami and Fort Lauderdale in the Pottinger decision, it had far-reaching effects in terms of saying you can't criminalize people unless there are legal places. Eugene has adopted a policy of tolerance up there, even though the law remains a misdemeanor. There have been no camping cases that have gone to court, according to activist Wayne Ford, who we interviewed a week ago on the Homeless Action Coalition in Eugene. How likely is it? How much resource would it take in terms of time and money to mount a significant challenge here locally? Because we have evidence now that the shelters are all full, and
oh, really?
That's testified. Yeah, that document is given out daily by the Homeless Services Center. We have evidence. Police chief has documented a 4 to 12 times greater assault rate on homeless people than those in houses, as of a December report, and that's only reported cases, so the actual number is more. What kind of legal support, how many attorneys, how much money would need to be amassed to actually do a significant legal challenge, and what kind of form might that take?
Well, it certainly would take a, it would be a test case that we need. Somebody who was turned away from all the shelters so that we could test the necessity defense. And that would be testing the constitutionality of the law as applied. How much money? I would say in the thousands of dollars. Somewhere between 5 and 10, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Given, you know, if I would be assured that I was going to have that some sort of income off this, so that I could continue to have a home myself, I could do it by myself.
Really?
Well, sure. I would welcome as much input as possible from other attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
As I always do, but the legal issues are there, period. It's just a matter of gathering the data and getting the right case.
We know that a previous effort that was launched back in 1992, the Seven Cities lawsuits in Santa Ana, Santa Barbara, Long Beach, Santa Monica, other cities down there, which eventually resulted in the Tobe decision, actually had initially a very favorable response at the Court of Appeals level, where they ruled that, you know, you couldn't go,
right.
You know, that the various things like the right to travel,
right.
The right to due process, and the right to equal protection of the laws was overturned at the Supreme Court level. But former attorney Ray Glock-Grunig, now a legal worker, apparently has worked with you on different occasions, stated that was only as a facial challenge, that is the actual law. They could conceive of a situation where the law might be relevant.
That's what I just said.
But
that's why I just said this would be challenging the constitutionality as applied.
Can you explain to the audience what this means?
In lay terms, it means that that the application of the law, the way they are applying the law to individuals, is unconstitutional, as opposed to the law itself being constitutional. In other words, the courts interpret a law to be constitutional if there is some, like you say, some way in which it can be applied constitutionally. So what they have done in California is withstand the facial challenge. In other words, just saying that the law itself can be okay, in some manner. In other words, if you have enough shelter spaces for everybody who's homeless, then it's a moot point. It's not a necessity that there be other ways of people sleeping. So that's the situation. So what we need to do is challenge it as applied, and that takes taking a necessity case where, preferably it would be a mother and her child, or some very sympathetic situation that we could.
There actually are numerous people who live in vehicles. I was reading about the case of one woman earlier in the show who, was driven with her baby out of town. They're parked in their motor home, and they've moved it up to the North Coast now. And now the sheriffs are running them out of there. So conceivably that could happen. I know also that a year or two ago there was another case that came down that ruled the necessity defense is an absolute requirement in camping tickets. That is to say that if you're charged with camping, it's not a judicial option whether to allow necessity. It is in fact a requirement, and I guess that's really a part of that old Tobe decision, right?
Right. It was the challenge in the application of the law.
And what that means, of course, is if you get called, if you get hauled into court on a camping ticket, then theoretically what you can do in practice is you can say, I would like to mount the necessity defense, the proof that, yes, I did violate the law, but there was a greater necessity. And the judge has to give you a hearing. You have to prove 6 conditions, which are rather onerous to show.
Kind of interesting in the Tobe decision as well, which, again, this was an outpouring of the Tobe decision, but the judge in that decision, the trial court judge, had a similar thing to say as Judge Kelly did here, when they talked about the fact that there wasn't any place, this was in Santa Ana, that judge ruled, well, why doesn't he just go to Tustin, which is the neighboring community? It's where I graduated from high school, so I know the area well.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just well, why doesn't he just sleep during the day? It was well, why doesn't he just move on to the next town? So
yeah,
similar judicial sentiment going on there. I think there'd be a good chance for success. And especially if, I hadn't realized that the shelters were full. And if that is the case, then... And there aren't any parking spaces, legal parking spaces.
No. Well, in theory, a person could get written permission of a business and...
Or
could sleep in a driveway for three nights.
Right.
Or could sleep in a church if there were no more than three vehicles in that church parking lot. But in practice, that's very hard to do.
Well, you know what would be helpful? It would be helpful to get a list of businesses for somebody to go business to business,
mm-hmm.
to those businesses that have parking spaces, and actually get a list of those businesses. Has that been done?
I think that that's part of the city council's charge to the homeless services center that it passed at the last council meeting, when it also said, please go and ask them to open the armory in the summer, even though they said they won't.
Because, again, see, that would be something where they could say, well, you know, there was a place for them to be. They just didn't take advantage of it.
Right.
So we need to have the raw data and the facts so that we can respond to that with, wait a minute, you know, there were only 15 businesses that allowed this, and all 45 of those spaces were taken. That sort of thing.
Any other issues that you've been working on? You're a civil rights lawyer yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That you think people should know about? Any interesting cases? Any upcoming hearings they should attend?
Well, I see some alarming trends happening in the court. Something I've been harping on for a long time. I've got another call coming through, and I'm expecting a call from my daughter in Helsinki.
Uh-oh.
Hold on just a sec.
Okay. You're listening to Kate Wells, attorney at law, who often takes pro bono cases for poor people and has done a lot of work around the sleeping ban. And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. These are the last 20 minutes of our show. We will return on Thursday at 6 o'clock in the evening.
Hello.
Was that your Helsinki call?
No, it wasn't.
You know, I have a question for you. Oh, boy, it escaped me. Go ahead with what you were talking about before.
Then. Oh, yeah, the alarming trend of increased immunity for officers when they violate your civil rights.
I do want to tell you about one victory. That's what I remembered.
Oh, okay.
For those who are interested in knowing it, and I thought it was mythological when Daryl Cole told me, he's the Sentinel reporter, it is possible to go check the booking sheets of anybody in the county at the sheriff's office on the third floor. I mean, we've had a lot of problems getting the police department to release police reports, and that still is a great problem. You can't get them unless you are a victim, or unless you pay, I think it's $64 right now for a report, and you have to also, there are other conditions too, the DA can't be prosecuting it, you have to, and it's all kinds of onerous conditions.
Richard Quigley actually has an appellate court decision that says police reports are public.
Whoa, I'd like to look at that, because we went through that one for hours and hours.
Oh, no, he definitely called Quigley. They, you know, in that case where he was challenging the action against him by Gotchalks,
mm-hmm.
They went in for a civil restraining order and brought in these police reports that he never even knew existed, that were unsubstantiated, never had been prosecuted, nothing. The sheriff's department handed them over to the private party who was suing Richard,
mm-hmm.
Gotchalks, and so Richard went back to the 6th District and said, wait a minute, you know, they can't do this, you know, and the 6th District did a written opinion that basically says police reports are public.
You mean for everybody or just for the interested parties?
Public.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Public.
Because what we've heard perennially from the city manager's office, from the Citizens Police Review Board, even mm-hmm. from the Homeless Issues Task Force,
mm-hmm.
although I think less from them than from the other two of the main groups, that these reports can be carefully controlled by the police department.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve Argue took 8 months looking for a police report when he was looking for his... I guess you're still doing his lawsuit against the city for assaulting him when he was trying to sell street newspapers.
That's correct, as well as for his treatment at jail.
Yeah, by Deputy Zamora.
Well, and in that first instance, he was deprived of his phone call. He was placed in solitary, was not fed for something like 18 hours. Then when he finally was fed, he was deprived of utensils, and they You know, they just told him he's going to have to eat his cereal and milk with his fingers. And so, yeah, there's some issues. A series of issues. Incarceration as well.
Well, you did win a victory as far as I know that you were. You have also been concerned at different times about the issue of, I guess it's both verified complaints and also the right to be taken to a magistrate.
Right.
The right to be taken to a magistrate is if you're stopped for a non-misdemeanor.
I haven't had the victory yet.
Well,
it's still in the... I have...
clarify what the issue is first.
Okay, the issue is that under 40302C of the vehicle code, you have an option to signing a ticket, and that is to be asked to be taken to a magistrate. At that time, when you are asked, when you do make that request, they are to take you forthwith to a magistrate or to the designated agent of a magistrate.
And that is not being booked and later being taken to a judge, right?
Absolutely not. They can arrest you for this for the purpose of taking you to a magistrate. That's what all the case law says.
Now, is this only for the vehicle code, or is this for other aspects of the penal code as well?
It's infractions.
Right.
These are for infractions, but the only time I've seen it is actually in the vehicle code, so I'm not sure if that's...
For example, the sleeping ban is now an infraction.
Right. Right.
So yeah. Could people demand to be taken to a magistrate?
You know, I don't know. It would be an interesting test case because it is, like I said, in the vehicle code. It's not in any other code.
Before you go into what's happened to it, let me just tell you that when I went up to check out the police records in the, I should say, this rumored notion that you could look at booking sheets since they were having such trouble getting access to police reports, I was first informed that that was not possible. Then I called back and I got from Kim Allen, their PR man, that it was possible. And I went in and I looked at them, and indeed, although sometimes apparently with a 3 or 4 day delay, all the police agencies in the county give booking sheets to this central public record. So you can go in and look at the booking sheets for the last however many days. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom of those booking sheets, there is a space that said, did this person request to be taken to a magistrate? Mm-hmm. And every single one of them says no. So I think that form may have been added to the form because you put through a formal concern to the Sheriff's Department that there be such a space, right?
Right, absolutely.
So I want to let you know you won a victory on that.
Good. Well, that's terrific news. I didn't even realize that they, of course, would never tell me.
Certainly not.
A victory unless they had to in some way.
So you haven't won a victory though on the issue of getting.
Well, we're still on appeal. It's an interesting thing because basically at the time that my client was taken to jail and booked and photographed and fingerprinted and put in with the general jail population and held for over 8 hours, never taken before a magistrate, even though. At the time he asked to be taken to a magistrate, it was like a 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, not a holiday. There was a magistrate available. There was no reason not to have taken him to a magistrate in accordance with the law. So at any rate, I did a motion to dismiss on his case based upon the violation of his constitutional rights on the criminal case.
This is locally in this county?
This is locally in this county.
And by taken to a magistrate, this would mean like having the police take him directly into a judge's court, right?
Or a magistrate, yeah. Yeah, perhaps I should give you a little bit of what I think the rationale for this is, and the important constitutional issue involved. The officer at the scene is your accuser, and you should not have to show your evidence to your accuser. In this case, it was a California driver's license, and he did in fact have his California driver's license, and he had his proof of insurance, but he wanted to show it to an impartial magistrate. Instead of to his accuser, which is right under the law.
Is this workable, Kate? As I guess that's the new key word, the new buzzword of our court system.
That's what I was about to say. The district attorney's response basically was that this law just isn't workable for us. Well, you know, I'm surprised he'd be surprised for me to tell him that this is working effectively in many, many counties who have either been forced to or have seen the writing on the wall and have voluntarily implemented these kinds of issues. I mean, after all, a magistrate has to be available 24 hours a day for issuance of search warrants, for many other things.
Well, I know up in what, was it?
Shasta.
Shasta County. B.E. Smith was definitely a
Henry,
kind of a...
Henry versus Shasta County was the...
One of the big forerunners. He would drive around without a license plate light on in order to get stopped, and finally they stopped stopping him because he would continue to insist to be taken to a magistrate.
Right.
By the way, is he still in jail on the marijuana situation?
Yes.
And that's not gotten any better. He was one of the first people convicted, even though he denied a cannabis medical... the 215 defense.
As far
as
I know, it's on appeal at this point in view of the Ninth Circuit decision that they could put on a medical necessity defense and the other...
And he's been jailed now for, about a year now?
I don't think it's been that long, but...
Feels that long.
Yeah, it feels that long, I agree. But at any rate, the district attorney came back and said that this law just isn't workable for us, and of course my response to that was, well, you know, if that's a valid defense to not obeying the law, I have a lot of criminal defendants. Would be very interesting. I mean, geez, Judge, this law just isn't working for me, okay?
Yeah. How can you stay awake all night?
So at any rate, the judge had bought the DA's opinion and not mine, and so now I have it on appeal, and in fact that hearing on that appeal, I believe, is either next week or the
following. This is a hearing
week.
By local judges?
Yeah, this is a Superior Court. Can do is hold you up to 2 hours to verify your identity. My client verified his identity with a valid and current U.S. passport at the time he was stopped. So, you know, they had no reason to hold him to identify him. So, the law is quite clearly on my side. So, if they choose to go ahead and...
Is this going to be a public presentation on this appeal?
Yeah.
What's the date?
Oh, I don't know. I'd have to go find my calendar, but it's on a Thursday, and it's either next Thursday or the following Thursday.
Please give me a call at 423-HUFF-KATE when you get to your calendar, and I will put it on, put it out to folks, because I think this could be, where does this usually happen?
It'll happen just in one of the courtrooms. We'll find out that day. I think the last time my hearing was in Department 6 or 7, but they change it around. It's different every time.
Is this a lengthy process or a short appeal? Or
three judges. Well, I've already done all of the briefing of it, so if anything, it'll just be a short oral argument. And if they have any questions about the situation, so. But we've already filed suit against the county and the city because this case has been going on for so long. We've had to file suit against them for what they did.
Well, we're talking to Kate Wells about the question of will the provision of the vehicle code and apparently of the penal code regarding infractions, it says that you have the right to be taken to a magistrate rather than, before you sign a ticket. That issue will again come up in local courts, I guess, sometime this Thursday or next. And if you want to find out more, give a call to 423-HUFF. We'll try to...
I think it's actually a week from Thursday.
A week from Thursday.
Well,
better than a week from Tuesday.
Yeah.
Kate, is there any more you want to say?
I can't think of anything other than the fact that, we just have to keep being vigilant of our rights, or they're quickly stripping us of it.
Ignore your rights and they'll go away.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks,
talk
Kate.
To you later.
Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 is interested in hearing about violations of your rights. At least my show is. I'm on every Sunday from 11 to 1:30 and on Thursday evenings from 6 to 8. So give me a call. I can do a very quick update on the Residentes Unidos Dolphin Lee demolition situation. There was a meeting on Friday night, as there is every week, of Residentes Unidos. They met at 7 o'clock at 124 Lee Brand Street, as they will next Friday night. Next Friday night promises to be quite a wing dinger, and I'm not terribly excited about it myself. I'm a little concerned. There may be three council members, the Redevelopment Agency Chief Seal Cirillo, Mercy Charities, housing bureaucrats, personnel, if you will. I'm afraid that I'm not too favorably disposed toward Mercy Charities Housing, I don't deny it, as well as community members and Residentes Unidos folks there and tenants from the Dolphin and Lee complexes. The issue, of course, is the city's initial plan to bulldoze this area and set up its own affordable housing project, which would essentially deny affordable housing to the people who already live there in favor of a different group of people chosen by Mercy Charities Housing. Some of them would come from that group. Some of them might come from another group. It's clear that not everybody in the current housing would be allowed back in, and that was the cutoff point for the tenants. They said, no way, we want guarantees. And they went and they refused to open up their houses to the city inspectors, not for any problems in there, but for a voluntary compliance with the new project's replacement housing plan, relocation plan, and that stopped the project. And so at that point, Fitzmaurice, Vice Mayor Fitzmaurice and Hernandez, who are the two main folks pushing the project and who are on the Relocation Advisory Committee, the kind of puppet group set up by the city council, which ironically ended up being taken over by the tenants, said that they want to close down the project. And now the tenants have been saying, no, we don't want to close the project. We want it simply to be really reflect the needs of the tenants who are there, that there are, you know, 70 to 100 families, and they can't be shoved into 34 units, as Mercy Charities Housing was proposing, 34 family units. Anyway, Mercy Charities Housing personnel came this last Friday, and they were going to make a short presentation or be there to speak to the tenants, and ended up being there for 2 hours, and I don't really blame, they can't be fully blamed for that. The tenants had a lot of things that they wanted to say. The problem was that Mercy Charities Housing, as it has throughout, had no documentation that they brought along. They brought no specifics on the laws. They brought no indications of the funding sources they wanted to use. They got no records of their housing policies and regulations and other complexes they control throughout the city, such as Neary Lagoon or Sycamore Grove. They didn't bring a list of the properties that they own. They didn't bring a list of the immigration law that would allow them to proceed with their funding of the project, building of the project, management of the project without worrying about immigration documentation. None of that stuff was brought along, though I requested it specifically in letters dating back as far as 2 months ago. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind listeners about the SCAN Housing Subcommittee.
Uh-huh.
Housing and Homelessness Subcommittee will be coming up 9 a.m. on Thursday, July 6th.
Wow, before the next edition of Bathrop Spears Broadside, you're going to have to go in cold on that one, folks.
At the SCAN office, which is kitty corner from the police station.
Yeah, that's in the kind of a little complex. It used to be, I guess, an old secondhand clothing store. Before that, it was the
IW. And more recently, Joe Grossman's campaign headquarters.
There you go. And I guess that's on, 324 Laurel Street or something?
It's
or
on Laurel Street. I don't know.
Not sure the exact address. 314.
But park in that little parking station if you're driving down there.
Park in the police station parking lot, which is actually a public parking lot. Yeah, and you can do that.
The police refuse to allow the city to post the sign that says it's a public parking lot.
The same police department that refused to allow their parking lot to be used for a homeless safe zone for overnight sleeping because quote, it wasn't safe and it wasn't patrolled by the police at night. Ah, I love it. These guys are worth a million. What can I say?
More like $13 million,
yeah,
if you count the police station.
That's correct, with $5-6 million overruns for the police station.
Uh-huh.
That was quite a story.
About the safe zones, Robert?
Yes.
Well, at least we still have those two extra homeless liaison officers that the council already gave them.
Probably officers.
We don't have any
yeah.
porta potties or dumpsters. We don't have any actual legal spots for homeless people to sleep, but at least we have those police officers.
Maybe we should have everybody line up at the police station to use their bathroom. That could be the way.
And that community room.
Yeah, the community room, which we still don't know how much it costs, though it's really kind of...
I was told $55 an hour.
How much?
I was told $55 an hour, and
no,
I was talking to the administrative secretary in Steve Belcher's office.
Right.
That's what she told me over the phone.
You know, this meeting of the SCAN Housing Committee, it's an interesting thing coming up at 9 a.m. on Thursday. It's going to be talking about the Dolphin Lease. SCAN had originally planned, as I understand it, Becky, to have a forum on this issue when there was this big Is the Mayor a Racist blow-up at the...
May 31st general meeting.
At the SCAN, right. The mayor, after Nena Ruiz, the resident of the Unidas representative, spoke about asking the SCAN membership to support their housing committee's resolution, saying hold off on the Dolphin Lee plan until you do a forum until the guarantees are granted to the tenants. Mayor Sugar stood up and sort of went into this peculiar support Mercy Charities Housing,
speaking on behalf of the city, I might add.
Yeah, he stood up as the mayor, which I guess a number of SCAN members found to be inappropriate, since the mayor doesn't have any official function at these SCAN meetings. In fact, it's a way of injecting the government into a private organization is inappropriate and sort of undue influence. he made comments about people being packed in like sardines and living in conditions of filth and squalor. And this, of course, became a brouhaha where tenants, I think properly, suggested this might be a racist perspective, certainly an elitist and a classist perspective. And that became, a football for Councilmember Hernandez, who then claimed that he was going to defend the Latino community.
I spoke to Councilmember Hernandez at his home about an hour ago, where he was rushing off to pick up his foreign exchange student from the airport and therefore couldn't call in to Bathrobes Pierre's broadside.
Well, perhaps we can catch him on Thursday after this committee meeting, but I guess what I wanted to point out was that this forum that was planned, the same group, the same time that they, I guess, scanned general membership, voted to have a forum to have the whole issue of the Dolphin Lee and Beach Flats affordable housing really worked out and discussed in a consensus.
Voted in by the general membership of SCAN.
Correct,
2-1
majority vote.
According to their bylaws, that is, you know, the ultimate direction of the
2-1 majority vote on that issue, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
In spite of eloquent appeals by Bernice Belton and Sandy Silver and those who have been essentially leading this process through its closed path with Catherine Byers in order to simply push it forward without there being this kind of public disclosure.
It's
that
passionate opposition and North bashing.
Yes, well, we won't get into that. In any case, the forum was supposed to be held, but then suddenly we heard the forum was going to be held on what, July
21st,
and also the city council was
and they booked the room too.
And they booked the room at the Loudoun Nelson, and also there was going to be a city council. The resolution was going to go to city council saying, hold up on this Dolphin Lee project, but certainly don't dump it, but hold up on it until you give them the guarantees
to build some community
and
consensus.
We have the forum for community consensus.
So they were saying there was no community consensus, so we have to stop and build some community consensus.
They said, you know, they're getting. Actually, it's a matter of basic rights for the tenants. Fuck the community consensus. But however, you know, they were using that as their pretext. That's fine. Then on, we learned that they were also told to bring to city council a resolution that specifically told the council that was what the SCAN general membership wanted to do. For some reason, the two co-chairs, Bernice Belton and Skip Spitzer, were unable to get this resolution in the 2.5 weeks between May 31st, well, the 2 weeks between May 31st and June 13th, the council meeting. In fact, it didn't get to the council until June 19th, as I understand it.
It was dated June 16th, but it wasn't received until June 9th.
Now, Bernice Belton, who's the co-chair and passionately opposed to this resolution, explained that, or at least Skip Spitzer explained for her, that she was having family problems and she just lost a loved one, her husband had died. But this woman who was grieving also apparently wasn't grieving sufficiently that she didn't want to go into closed meetings with the mayor and others at her own house.
On June 7th,
and then there were more meetings that were held later. At least I know about that June 7th meeting, in which you want to describe what happened there?
Oh, well, that was the one that Michael Hernandez was at, where he claims he heard Keith Shiger say that the Hispanic people living at the Dolphin Lee were living like pigs. And that was his source of his comment for demanding that he resign. But then there was a later subcommittee meeting that I'm actually having trouble figuring out who set this up, but
I think I can help you on that. On the Friday before the most recent city council meeting, June 27th was the most recent meeting. The SCAN steering committee, having met the week before with the SCAN housing committee, having met the week before with Residente Unidos to work out the idea of the forum, then met with Mercy Charities. But Mercy Charities told the SCAN people that, oh no, this project is dead. We're not going to come forward with it at all. We're not going to be a part of this forum. And they told me the same thing in a letter, even though there had been no official movement. Maybe it's dead if they say it's dead. Maybe they have some unusual secret internal process, a pipeline to the ear of Catherine Byers. It's not clear.
City Council had not at that point.
Yeah, there was no public
project.
Statement, and it hasn't been killed, as we can see. They were wrong. But they said, we're not going to be a part of this forum. Well, then did SCAN say, okay, then we'll go ahead without you. We'll do whatever we can. We'll send us whatever documentation you have. We'll use whatever was written in the media, or it was
that, you know, we know about you. No, what they did at a special steering committee meeting on Monday, the Monday before the city council meeting, that's this last Monday, they got together and they decided they were going to postpone indefinitely any such forum in violation of the mandate by the general membership on May 31st because Mercy Charities Housing was not attending. Now, I mean, Mercy Charities Housing, what is this? Who runs? And we know that they have powerful influence in the city council. We know they are the sole service provider of all the low-income affordable housing. Do they also run SCAN as well? I mean, what's going on here, Becky?
Well, I'm still trying to figure this out because when a general membership meeting votes to have a forum, the housing subcommittee, which I'm on, we didn't vote to not have a forum on Dolphin Lake. They did say that they wanted to have people from both sides. So I guess this went to the steering subcommittee meeting, which I was not at. But coming out of the steering subcommittee, they set up another subcommittee proposed of Sandy Silver, Bernice Belton, Tim Fitzmaurice, Andy Schifrin, and one other person, all of them who had voted against the resolution on May 31st.
Are you sure about that? Because I think you're naming the people who are at
I'm just reading, you know, this was in the minutes of the...
So it was actually set up, that sub... Because that sounds like an incredibly biased subcommittee. These are all individuals who favor the old Dolphin Lee demolition project.
Well, you know, that's... my reading of it is that they were supposed to... went for this forum, they were going to set up their point of view and elect who was going to be on the forum from their point of view. And then the Residentes Unidos would decide who was going to be on from their point of view. And they would have this forum and discussion, and the community could sort out the pros and cons of this project and, you know, come up with something to end this loggerheads that we have right now between the tenants and the city over, you know, the tenants are refusing to give information about how many households they have and how many people are in each household, which the city needs to proceed with the replacement housing plan. And they don't want to give that information up until they get relocation and return guarantees, which the council had been saying they were going to get all along, but somehow they couldn't put it in writing in any kind of legal official way. So that's where the impasse has been. So, you know, for SCAN to suddenly say, oh, we don't want to have a forum, and it seems to me that it's violating their own bylaws, which hold what the a vote of the general meeting to be superior to any subcommittee or steering committee decision.
Well, I think Scott Graham put it in his own way when he talked about Bernice Belton's Tea Party here is making the decisions for SCAN instead of the SCAN general membership's motions being respected, and not to mention the basic rights of tenants and low-income people being as important, if not more important, than whatever Mercy Charities. You know, the question was raised to me today, did Mercy Charities, one of the motivations that's never been suggested, and that we didn't ask Mercy Charities on Friday when I guess five of their folks showed up at the Residentes Unidos meeting, we were trying to be nice and, you know, talk to them in a friendly way, although in a way that's kind of hypocritical. I'm not necessarily, it's important to be uncivil, but it's important, I think, to hold them to answer the questions that they've refused to answer for the last 3 or 4 months. But something that Fred Geiger brought up that I'm not going to have time to play today because I'm already over time and Little Red Hen should be here shortly, is the consideration that it may be that Mercy Charities has already paid for the plans and the architectural designs for these buildings. And if that's the case...
up to 15% of the cost for the entire project.
Yeah, maybe Mercy Charities Housing is afraid it's going to take a hit here and is not being entirely honest. It wants to proceed with an original plan, even though that plan would exclude a significant number of the current tenants.
Well, for 48 units, and we're talking about, you know, the leapfrogging or perhaps sacrificing the community center and the child daycare center to build instead sufficient units to house everybody who's currently at the Dolphin and the Lee apartment.
So what's coming up next Friday is going to be...
If they've already drawn up those plans, obviously those plans won't work.
Right, and they would have to take a loss on that.
And I'm sorry that the tenants didn't ask, how much has Mercy Charities Housing already been paid for this project?
Well, there are a number of questions I wish they'd asked, and I wish that, the questions were asked them much earlier on paper, and they've refused to answer them. So I'm hoping, I think that they'll be sent another letter, and midweek they'll be expected to answer. If they don't answer by then, it'll become clear that they, I think that they're continuing their policy of, we'll rely on our friends inside the city council to proceed. We would rather have our way or the highway, or my way or the highway, as they say.
Before you do,
I'm going to say what I was going to say a moment ago, which is that, because I haven't got much time, we're already 10 minutes over time, is that the...
But you haven't given announcements for upcoming meetings.
I will. What I'm saying is next Friday...
You haven't talked about Club Cruise yet.
Well, we want to hear about that in just a moment. On Friday at the Residente Unidos meeting coming up, where we intend... Nena Ruiz has invited council members, and the point that was brought up at the last meeting was that the guarantees question cannot be resolved without other individuals, both from the redevelopment agency and council members, being present. So she's going to attempt to do that, which I think is, of course, a very large project to do in such a short period of time, and with given the kind of mixed feelings and mixed signals on the city council. But it will be quite a meeting. It'll be at 7 o'clock on Friday coming up.
Well, I know the invitation went out, but has that been accepted yet?
I don't know.
I haven't heard that.
I don't know even if the invitation has really gone out in the clearest form that it could have. I'm kind of hoping that it doesn't go out, because I think the tenants need more time to talk among themselves about what to do, and they need to organize in the community first. But that's me. The tenants will do what they want to do. You have a number of announcements to make, and again, if people want to come to this meeting, 7 o'clock, 124 Lee Brandt Street, in the evening, Residente Unidos Lee Apartments. So just come on down. If you want more information, you can always give a call to Nena Ruiz at 466-9520. Go ahead with your announcements, Becky.
Okay, let's see. Beginning July 4th, 7 p.m. on Channel 27 now, is Club Cruise. That's with Fred Geiger is the guest and Robert Norris the host. So you heard them... you've heard Fred and Robert on the show earlier, and now you get to see what they look like. Thursday, 6 o'clock, July 6th at 9 a.m. is the SCAN Housing and Homelessness Subcommittee at the SCAN headquarters, so we already talked about that. Friday, the 7th, Residentes Unidos. Saturday, July 8th, is the SCAN Good Government Forum at the Vets Hall, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Then on my calendar, next Tuesday the 11th, Club Cruise, Channel 27, is the interview with Robert Norris and Steve Argue. That includes clips of the May 22nd Lefevre mother and child mashing incident for people to look at one more time. And that will also be repeated on Thursday the 13th. On Monday the 17th is the Joint Citizens Police Review Board City Council meeting, the Ordinance Review Committee meeting, and I think Bob talked about that earlier, that they're currently seeking written input from the public. And that's about it.
Wow, that's quite a list. I think we could probably put some of those on the Huff line if you didn't catch all of them. That's 423-4833, and you can pick up on that rather exhaustive list. Thank you, Becky, for going through the trouble of making that up.
No problem.
I know that you were also looking for an interview with Arnold Abbott, the Fort Lauderdale, what do you call him, the beach bum saint? he's not a beach bum. He's on the beach, and they're treating him like a bum, but he's actually a...
Feeding homeless people on the beach as part of his church.
Right, well, that kind of church I don't think is wanted around there. Probably not wanted around here either.
The judge recently ruled in his favor and said that he can't be prohibited from feeding the poor on the beach.
Until the city provides him with another feeding area, but then they went and did that, and we haven't found out what the latest is there, because he's gone back to the beach to feed, I guess, on was it Wednesday?
Yeah, they offered him a site that was on about 20 miles from away, out by a parking lot that was a piece of land connected to the parking lot with their sports stadium, and where no homeless people are. And that was the site, and that was completely unacceptable for the church. So Arnold Abbott was planning to go feed on the following Wednesday We haven't heard what happened then, but he was told that if he did feed, he would be arrested.
Right, he's delayed feeding on the beach for a number of years for that reason, because he's very concerned about legalities. I guess there's also a matter of church politics involved there, too. And I guess you did an interview with him, but we're still looking for that interview, as usual.
We'll have to have it on an upcoming show, Robert.
Right, plus, of course, the George Cavallo interview. We're hoping that George, who's the ombudsperson, local ombudsperson for those who are enmeshed in the psychiatric chew-em-up, shoot-em-up, and spit-em-out system, that's the mental health system, will be able to...
And some frightening legislation coming up.
Yeah, tonight. AB 1800 will be able to come on the air and talk about that. Unfortunately, he didn't get to us today, and we mislaid his home phone number. He wanted us to give him a call and remind him
George,
to come on down.
George, if you're out there, call 423-HUFF.
Yeah, George, 423-HUFF is the number. We'll be calling you tomorrow at your job when you return to work. He works in the little building right across from the jail and across from the county building where you can get a little advice on how to deal with a situation if you get locked up on a 5150 and they're trying to forcibly drug you. Call help and get George in there.
He's your psychiatric ombudsman.
Ombudsperson. Thank you very much. Ombudsman used to be ombudswoman, and then it's ombudsperson. So that's an old Swedish term, has to do with an advocate for a particular group, and I guess some suggest that the homeless need such a person. I think the Homeless Issues Task Force suggested that, but haven't heard a word from Mayor Sugar and the power behind the throne, Catherine Byers, and the power behind the power behind the throne, Mike Rotkin. Yeah.
We haven't heard a word about what, if any, of the recommendations of the Homeless Issues Task Force the City Council would
Yeah, more recommendations
implement.
Gone without a trace. Nor have I heard from Keith Sugar if he wants to do any kind of mediating before we begin formal procedures on Brown Act violations. I've been threatening to do this for months because there have been real substantial documented Brown Act violations that Sugar continues to repeatedly do. I think, he and I, while we have our personal differences, and he seems to regard me as some kind of exponent of the Black Plague, major power tripper, whatever.
The brother of the devil.
That's Hernandez. He says I'm the brother of the devil.
Oh, right.
But, you know...
I'm mixing them up.
I've asked Sugar to, let's get together, get some ground rules for people who want expanded public comment. Not just me, but a lot of people in the community. And silence so far has been the result. Let's hope that that silence ends. Also, I want to say that Michael Hernandez did call in earlier this week. He only had one thing to say on my message machine, which was that he had been to Denver, Colorado. I think it was Denver. It was a large city in Colorado. I think of Denver. And he said that he was impressed that in their mall there was not one homeless person. He didn't mention, of course, that 6 or 7 homeless people were killed last year in Colorado.
Some of them beheaded.
Some of them beheaded, and he didn't mention why that was such a good thing. I guess maybe he was afraid, maybe he was suggesting they had all come to Santa Cruz to park in vans in the safe zones. He didn't say that, so I can't say what he said. And he's obviously rushing off to pick up relatives, so
yeah,
can't be on the air.
Whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, he was saying. I mean, if there are no homeless people, is there a city in Colorado that solved the homeless problem? I haven't heard of it. Or is he saying that there's something wrong, that there are no homeless people here? What happened to them?
The mystery of Michael Hernandez. I did commend him last week for bringing up the issue of the building that could be a shelter that nobody else wanted to talk about out on the west side, and also for pointing out that we need the city staff, not just old Ken Cole over at the Homeless Services Center, to start calling up all the businesses and all the churches again to find out if they will allow homeless people to park their vehicles.
Robert, why don't you do a public service and call for all the businesses to call the Huff line, and if they have a space in their parking lot that they want to let a homeless person stay overnight in, they can call 423-HUFF, and, there's one now, and they can tell us their business, and we'll
well, I'll let you take that call, Becky, and of course, you've made that call. Maybe they will be calling in. I'll hang up. Let's give them a chance to call in,
okay,
shall we?
So now's your chance, all you eager business owners out there. Give a call to 423-4833 at the Huff line, or if you want, while I'm still on the air, and you can get your own 2 cents in, or $50 in, depending on how much you're charging for whatever you're selling these days. here on the free radio line. It's 427-3772. Normally at this time, we have the Little Red Hen with Emma and Baba Yaga doing the bringing the younger generation into the studio, or else speaking out so the younger generation can get the benefit of the radio. But they haven't arrived, so I am continuing with my tirades, and because I usually have more than enough to cover whatever radio time has allowed me. I want to remind folks that there is a meeting today of ROAR, Restore Our American Rights, out at the Harvey West Industrial Park, and I think that now is the time for folks to come together, and if you can't make it to this meeting, please give a call to 423-HUFF. If you have any reports, if you have any interest in supporting this organization, if you have any concerns or things you want to say about what's been happening with homeless people and police around the sleeping situation, or just general police treatment and business and merchant and public treatment of homeless people. It's a particularly important issue right now because it is still coming up on the agenda at City Council, at least in terms of it's being placed on the ballot in November. As you may remember, Bob LaMonica is of the view that this is still a good idea to put it on the ballot. So is David Silva. David Silva usually calls into the show for some reason. Maybe he's been thwarted by the fact that we've been on the phone a lot. He's welcome to call in if he gets here before Emma or Baba Yaga show up. We will certainly put him on. And I don't mean put him on. I mean put him on the air. That's what I mean. And we'll put you on, too, if you call for 427-3772. The sleeping ban is the subject of a poll in the Sentinel. For those of you who want to check it out, you can actually just go to www.santacruzsentinel.com. That'll do it. And you can vote. As of last, 2 or 3 hours ago, 66.6% said no safe sleeping zones, 33.3% said yes, and the question was, should the city set up safe sleeping zones for the homeless in the Harvey West Natural Bridges Industrial Areas? And there were 1,032 votes. And I would like to know from folks out there, what do they think of this election, putting it on the November ballot? I mean, I've always supported that. And then, you know, before this most recent political brouhaha, I mean, I much prefer to see it passed by the city council. David Silva reached this point, and I got angry with him. I felt he, in a way, I'd use the word sell out at different points without consulting with us. And David does tend to make unilateral decisions of different things, as do I at different times. But I think on such important matters as negotiating with people at city council, when the city council members have closed the meetings, it's really important to consult with other people and other groups, particularly with me, man. Anyway, so he made the decision that because things were proceeding too slowly and not probably accurately judged that it was just being dragged out to death by the city staff, that instead he liked Celia Scott's proposal of putting everything on the ballot and forgetting safe sleeping zones now. I didn't. I thought that was a mistake because I thought that we needed to press forward with getting the council to act, and I still think we need to get the council to act on this issue immediately, if not sooner. I don't think he really disagrees with me. He thinks the council needs to take meaningful action. David Silva does, as well as other people. And I think we can still give a call to that city council at 420-5017, 420-5017. Call the city council right now. I know you've done it 100 other times, but hey, it's time for call 101 and tell them time to do something immediately. Put the porta potties and dumpsters in the affected areas. Act to implement the Homeless Issues Task Force resolution. Now, that'll kick their ass down the road. That's gone even further, much further than the lifting the sleeping ban. It lifts the entire camping ban because it says not only is it legal to sleep, it has to be legal to shelter yourself against the elements, which again is a no-brainer. But there are so many people with can't say they haven't got brains. Their brains have become disattached from their hearts in this community, in positions of power. Their eyes are glued to the next election. That's all they can think about, or to special small interest groups on the west side or businesses, that they have forgotten the elementary things. And no matter how many times we tell them, they don't seem to remember, so we have to say so in a fashion that really sends them a message. And I continue to think that a combination of a civil rights suit, as suggested by Kate Wells, anybody out there with $10,000 they want to kick in, and also a an ongoing protest that is high profile downtown, again, same thing, possibly involving lockdowns or first earth first type tactics. And I was reassured to see that this kind of stuff, tree sits, are being done here in the Santa Cruz area. Thank you, Earth Firsters. I'd love to get some Earth Firsters stepping forward to help us with the sleeping ban. I guess we need to work on the formal process around that. I've been talking about it and not doing anything about it. Maybe, you know, I don't know what will get us together to do it, but something needs to be done. I will be at this ROAR meeting today at 4:30, and I'm hoping that we'll get some different members of the community. In the meantime, sending phone calls and emails to City Council that why the hell are you abandoning the safe zones without any documented specifics about problems there when you haven't even put in the porta-potties and dumpsters you should have? Where do you expect homeless people to sleep? You're again, putting them in the criminal situation where they're all over the city, where there is no legal place to be. And so every place is equally... There's no premium for being a tidy camper. There's no premium for being a considerate camper. It's just a matter of, you know, take what you can and hide where you can. And I guess the idea is that the police are somehow going to put all this right with their batons, their midnight lights, their ticket books, you know, and their sirens. And I'm afraid that's just not going to happen. Just the situation is going to get worse. A couple of quick notes. Jim Hightower, you might know, is now on KOMY, which is the sister station to KSCO. It's at 1340. It's every morning from 9 to 11 on Monday through Friday. That's an AM station. I don't normally advertise them, but I like Hightower, and I think he's fun to listen to. He's a sort of a response, an intelligent man's response to Rush Limbaugh, and he's also very humorous. Check him out, 1340, 9 to 11, Monday through Friday, 1340 AM. I tried to respond to an editorial, well, an interview with Mike Rotkin on the afternoon KSCO show, or maybe it was KOMY, their sister stations, or the same station at different frequencies with slightly different programming. And I called up Rosemary to ask how to get on there, and Rosemary called me back and said that the show people who were running it, and one of them, I guess, was Steve Free, that was his name, that he was tired of having my voice. He wanted somebody else other than me. But when I called Steve, I happened to call again this morning, ran into him on the air, I was told that Rosemary had told him that because I work for another radio station or I'm on another radio station, I have a conflict of interest and would not be allowed on KSCO. Now, the interest, and this, of course, is preposterous. If they barred anybody who was in any other media from being on, every member of Free Radio Santa Cruz would be barred from being an interviewer or a guest or on, you know, interviewed on KSCO for news stories, which is ridiculous. And every other media person would be barred, regardless of what other hats they wear. So this is clearly, there's something else operating here, and I'm going to try to find out what it is. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I had an interview with Bill, the owner of the Santa Vita Trailer Park. And at that time, Bill got the lion's share of the interview, as well as sort of the lion's share of the credit. It was Bill versus the Big Bad County Planning Commission. And I've since learned some new information, which may indicate that old Bill may simply be trying to make sure that rent control doesn't reach his RV folks. We're going to be talking more about that. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Lydia calling.
Hey, Lydia.
Calling to say that the scan office is at 314 Laurel.
Thank you. That's good. Lydia, I know you've been you were one of the few diehards who were at the city council meeting late at night on June 28th in the very wee hours of the morning when finally the safe sleeping zones were given a quick and dirty burial by Catherine Byers. That's at least how I'd put it.
Yes.
Any comments on what happened there that night?
Yeah, well, I think you got pretty close to saying why you were arrested back on, what was it, Thursday?
Yeah, actually, I did get into it today. The technical reason I was arrested was because I was not at the mic. I was standing off to the side. Although if you listen to the tape, you can barely hear my voice. I responded to Keith Sugar's repeated interruptions of Becky Johnson at the mic by saying, "Stop interrupting her."
Yeah, I was there.
And his response was, "Leave the chambers," and I said, "No." And as a consequence, I was
told that he would swear out a criminal complaint and that I would be barred from the next meeting. Is that essentially accurate? Or?
Yeah, and it's not a legal issue, probably, because of First Amendment rights, but there is an sort of, quote, ethical and request that people not address and criticize individual members of the council from the public standpoint, the public podium, and that was being done, and that was...
That's what Becky was doing that at the podium, and I guess Mayor Sugar was responding to that, though it has to be said...
It has to be said that she was not arrested, you were.
Right. Well, also, earlier in the evening, other members of the were doing the same thing, although in a positive light. At the oral communications period in the early evening, one member actually individually addressed six of the seven council members with no comment. And I want to further point out that another member, Nora Hockman, addressed Mayor Sugar from the audience repeatedly, out of turn, out of order, and was in no way threatened with arrest or barred from the next council meeting, whereas I made one comment on his behavior, perhaps two, and was...
Perhaps more than two.
Well, I don't think I put him in a position where he couldn't do business. I don't think that was at all what had happened. It was the end of the evening, they were taking a vote. I commented, let this woman speak.
There were personal political attacks being made, and they were not having any of it. And that was my view on it. I'm very, very concerned. Thank you for a very good show. I'm glad that I didn't miss Carvalho. I only tuned in about an hour ago.
No, you didn't miss him. He didn't show up.
Again, I'm sorry. And I don't know his phone number. And I very, very much hope that he is interviewed at some point.
Well, we can talk a little bit about AB 1800. The show is, as you notice, probably a half hour beyond its regular time. I haven't heard from the other talk show hosts as to what they want done, and so I'm taking the liberty of proceeding. Well, when I get off the phone, they'll have another opportunity to call me. If you'd like to talk about AB 1800, which, of course, is the proposed new draconian set of restrictions that make it much more make it easier for people to be committed and held involuntarily, we can talk about that.
I'd like to do it when he's there.
Okay.
And he's a wonderful human resource of this community, an extremely important one.
Sure. Of course, that may be, I'm not sure if we can ever get him in here, but we're going to keep trying.
Yeah. My comment on David Silva's situation with the attempted forced
right. Let's review that for the audience. Back in, I guess, the council meeting before the current one, on June 13th in the afternoon, David Silva, who was there, acting quite rational. I saw no matches, gasoline, or anything of the sort that would indicate any kind of violent intentions. He had made a threat to the mayor, or I should say to the city council, an assertion of principle almost, that that he and others might immolate themselves at city council meeting. They were so upset. This was on Thursday the next day he rescinded those threats, and I mean, he said he'd worked out a deal. He went through the Celia Scott proposal to put the stuff on the ballot and forget the safe zones right now through the council process, which again I thought was a mistake, but he did come up with that, and he had reached an understanding, and the police did not seem to be any way alarmed at his presence. It was only when he walked up to into the line to speak, as Nena Ruiz was speaking at the mic, that apparently a police officer called him outside, and then they handcuffed him and took him away, you know, with a crowd of people wondering what the hell was...
Away to the so-called behavioral health unit.
Correct. And held him for a couple hours, where he was called, I guess, the most sane person they'd ever met, or one of the saner people, or some such thing.
Yeah, well, my comment on that is that if someone in the public, including the mayor or anyone, is seriously concerned that someone is suicidal, you act immediately. You don't wait 5 days and catch them in line at the city council. You act immediately, and I say that as a licensed therapist.
You are, and how long have you been a licensed therapist?
3 years.
And you were actually at a press conference with David Silva. I last saw you there, I guess, it was the Wednesday after the council meeting when the safe zones were repealed. Were not really repealed, they'd never been put into law, but you showed up at a press conference outside Texas Instruments that David called to essentially focus on the misinformation and bigotry coming out of Texas Instruments. And David was there. Did he seem to be behaving in a fashion that seemed suicidal or irrational?
I would not attempt to assess David. I am a friend of his, and I don't make assessments. No, as a friend, I would say no, he was not suicidal.
He didn't seem that way to me. I mean, I certainly disagree with him.
And I disagree with the idea of having a fast for a man who is so disabled with AIDS, but I don't regard that as suicidal, but an act of principle.
I took part in that press conference because I was extremely concerned that the city council, after we had an opportunity to speak at 1 a.m., whenever it was, on Wednesday morning, the city council, a member of it, said that the safe zones had been given a try and failed. They were not given a try. They were not officially sanctioned. They were not supported with the equipment that you've named so often, the porta potties and the dumpsters. It was not a fair shake. And then to say that they had failed after a decent attempt when the second reading of the law had never even occurred and no one had been informed properly about the law, because there was no law, no ordinance, I was horrified by that. I'm extremely disappointed.
And plus, you haven't even mentioned, Lydia, that police officers were reportedly not enforcing other ordinances in that zone, which would have made it likely that they would fail if it were... I mean,
I don't know about it. I wouldn't put it...
Well, I mean, I don't have... The documentation I have about that comes from the complainants from Texas Instruments and the people who spoke at City Council meeting on June 13th, who were business owners in the Mission Street extension area, as well as those who called into Voices from the Village two nights later, and a program that included talk about the safe sleeping zones, or that was the main topic. They repeatedly said that the police refused to enforce other laws there, such as littering, defecating, urinating, disturbing the peace, drug use, because they were told by the City Council not to. Now, they could be lying to us, I guess,
but
they made these statements publicly. And did Mayor Byers, it really is Mayor Byers, isn't it? But did Councilmember did Councilmember Byers ask for documentation to say, here, these are the 73 incidents that make us believe we've given this a fair try, even though it was never announced, it never passed a second reading, nothing was ever put in place? I mean, there was no documentation provided. That was another thing that I was rather disturbed about.
It's a very, very sad and bad situation. I don't know what's next. I do feel that it should be on the ballot, although I'm afraid that it would not succeed.
Mainly, I would say not because that's what... I think people would be misled by advertising on this and by financial, you know, a lot of money being spent one way or the other to misrepresent the issue. That's as it was misrepresented repeatedly in the emails we saw coming into City Council. But who knows? Maybe the electorate has more integrity than the politicians. I would certainly hope so at some level.
Well, thank you so much for a good program. I really appreciate Kate Wells' presentation, her